Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
It seems trying to figure out in advance who might be the next school shooter is easier said than done.
They don't have access to our system. We don't have access to their system. So I can't stand here in good conscience and tell you that it's happening.
Also this week, the Florida Supreme Court debates what makes a weapon, and it could come down to how you use your toaster.
I mean, there are some people who are kind of strange, and I guess they toast their toasts while they're taking a bath. So if it happens to drop in there and something happens, obviously the intent is not there to commit harm.
We'll also find that some sheriff's offices in Florida are now doing at least part of the job the State Department of Children and Families used to perform, and we'll visit a classroom where Florida's longstanding denial of automatic voting rights restoration for former felons sparks a spirited debate. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Before we get into the body of tonight's show, here's some late breaking news. The Orlando Sentinel reporting that for more than a year, the state of Florida failed to conduct national background checks on tens of thousands of applications for concealed weapons permits that would potentially allow drug addicts or people with a mental illness to carry firearms in public. A previously unreported Office of Inspector General investigation found that in February of 2016, the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services stopped using an FBI crime database called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. That ensures applicants who want to carry a gun do not have a disqualifying history in other states. The employee in charge of the background checks could not log into the system, the investigator learned. The problem went unresolved until discovered by another worker in March of 2017. That means that for more than a year, applications got approved without the required background check. During that time, which coincided with the June 12, 2016 shooting at Pulse nightclub that left 50 dead, the state saw an historic spike in applications for concealed weapons permits. There were 134,000 requests for permits in the fiscal year ending in June of 2015. The next 12 months broke a record, 245,000 applications. That was topped again in 2017 when the department received 275,000 applications. Department employees interviewed for the report called the checks extremely important. Concealed weapons licenses may have been issued to potentially ineligible individuals, it was found. All this happening under the oversight of Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, now running for Florida governor as a Republican. His campaign has touted his expansion of concealed carry permits as one of his top accomplishments. The commission charged with improving school safety is looking into the effectiveness of school resource officers, a school's main line of defense that critics say failed students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School amid a Valentine's Day shooting. 17 students died, more than a dozen others were injured, and we get more on the story from Lynn Hatter.
The School Safety Commission is looking into the role and responsibilities of school resource officers. It's an evolving one, says the Florida SRO Association's Tim Enos.
You know, part of the whole thing is when you talk about an SRO, the whole in a nutshell is it really is about is the triad concept. It's about teacher, counselor, and law enforcement.
Schools and their individual needs can change as well over time.
As you're an elementary SRO, you're going to do a lot more teaching than you are going to be doing law enforcement. By the time you get to high school, you're going to do a lot more law enforcement than you're going to talk to teaching. But ultimately, they're going to be there. They're going to be a counselor. They're going to be a mentor, and they're supposed to be available in order to the administration, the staff, the school, as well as the students, faculty, the parents, to be able to provide guidance on a variety of different issues so that they wear a tremendous amount of different hats while they're on campus.
In the wake of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, the Florida legislature allocated millions of dollars to put more SROs into schools. But the money still isn't enough to cover all the costs of putting an officer in each public school in the state. And while that's a state metric, Sheriff Bob Gualtieri points out the recommendation of a national SRO group is higher.
But it is a national organization that's published a recommendation that the ratio be one SRO per 1,000 students. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
So who's published that?
I believe that was from within NASRO in reference to their own recommendation.
Varying philosophies on the role of the SRO in the school could lead to problems, like whether a principal chooses to report a student due to reluctance of feeding the school to prison pipeline. And that's led to an increased focus on a program in Broward, which was designed to keep kids from getting criminal referral. It's called the Promise Program, and it's come under fire in the wake of the shooting. Critics say Broward has protected kids who otherwise should have been under arrest. Supporters say it's granted troubled kids a second chance. Nicole Anderson heads the Broward SRO program.
The Promise program is facilitated by the school board, so it would be the school board officials that do the Promise program referral. Where we come in is that with the Promise program, it's an administrative process within the school board, so they're getting these chances in the Promise program.
Yet there are circumstances, says Anderson, where a student has been referred to the program multiple times. That's because the SROs, the district, and the broader law enforcement agencies are all using different databases. Those databases don't all talk to one another despite state law mandating uniformity, says Democratic State Senator Lauren Buck.
Under Florida statutes would require DJJ and the sheriff, chiefs of police, and district school superintendent in each county to enter an interagency agreement for the purpose of sharing information, which I would believe that then we would all be sharing information about juvenile offenders among parties. So might understand that that is not currently happening.
Anderson says it's not.
No, because they don't have access to our system. We don't have access to their system. So I can't stand here in good conscience and tell you that it's happening.
Chairman and Pinellas Sheriff Bob Gualtieri says that's a problem across the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Could your Audi be considered the equivalent of an AR-15? What makes a weapon a weapon? The Florida Supreme Court heard arguments on Shepard versus State of Florida and now must decide. Noah Hertz reports the decision could come down to the proper use of a toaster.
If we look at Webster's dictionary, it says weapon applies to anything used or usable in injuring, destroying, or defeating an enemy or opponent.
How about Black's dictionary, which says that an instrument used or designed to be used to injure or kill someone?
That was Justices Charles Kennedy and Peggy Quince. The case at hand is that of Adam Lloyd Shepard. In 2011, Shepard got into an argument with a man at a bar and later that night struck him with his car, killing him. Central to the understanding of this case is how the Florida legal code defines a weapon. To understand that, there's some old cases to delve into. The first of these is the 1926 Florida Supreme Court case Williamson versus State. The year is 1925, and Ed Williamson used his Ford Model T to kill Ed McWilliams. Here's Justice Kennedy.
In that case, if we quote another court where it said the deadly weapon is not one that must kill or that may kill, but the one which would likely produce death or great bodily injury used by the defendant in the manner in which it was used. And then we talk about somebody, a large stick may constitute a deadly weapon. And we ultimately conclude that yes, an automobile can be a deadly weapon.
The next case to understand is State versus Houck from 1995. Shepard's attorney, Matthew Kachergas, points to that case as an example of why the car in question could not be used as a weapon.
The defendant in that case was accused of homicide, I think it was manslaughter, by pounding a gentleman's head into the pavement. And this court found that the pavement could not be considered a weapon.
Ultimately, the Florida Supreme Court decided in Houck versus State that weapons had particular definitions as outlined by the legislature in the decision in Williamson versus State. Yet Justice Kennedy challenged the argument.
You wield a weapon, you control it. So you can wield a hammer. I think you can wield a car, okay? You can control that. But you can't wield the ground. You can't wield or control the tree.
Kennedy goes on to add.
You've got to have some intent. For instance, if you negligently, culpably, but negligently drop a hammer out a window and it lands on somebody's head, now, even though a hammer could be used as a weapon, it wouldn't be a weapon in that context.
Kachergas argues by basing the definition of a weapon on intent, the court opens, in his words, a Pandora's box. The court was split on this. Justice Kennedy argues that if it is used as a weapon, keyword being used, then why wouldn't it be a weapon? Justice Barbara Pariente has similar concerns to Kachergas. Justice George Labarga explores the idea, comparing it to bathing with a toaster.
I mean, there are some people who are kind of strange, and I guess they toast their toasts and while they're taking a bath. So if it happens to drop in there and something happens, obviously the intent is not there to commit harm. However, if somebody purposely throws a toaster in a bathtub when somebody's taking a bath, obviously the intent, the use of the weapon changes.
Labarga goes on to address vehicles.
Same thing with an automobile. I mean, no one in their right mind today can deny that cars are being used as weapons to kill people. We turn the TV on every day and see that.
Shepard was charged with one count of manslaughter and one count of leaving the scene of a crash that resulted in a death. If the Supreme Court decides that the vehicle used by Shepard is a weapon, Shepard's charge could be enhanced to murder. Before they decide this, though, the definition of a weapon remains in question. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Noah Hertz.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the debate over restoration of voting rights to Florida's former felons takes to the classroom.
Nature of this is just asking questions rather than trying to promote any one particular view. What are the implications?
A North Florida county will soon become the first in the panhandle to assume the child protection investigative duties traditionally done by the state.
While 60 other county sheriffs don't want to take over the CPI responsibilities, the Walton sheriff is ready to take on this program to further protect the children of Walton County.
And a concerted effort to make offshore oil and natural gas exploration seem like a desirable deal for Florida is gearing up.
You see a lot of fiber being put into directional drilling stuff. You can be in one place and drill to another place and avoid interfering with things.
A Florida State University professor has brought together three of the school's colleges to take part in a unique course covering the state's ongoing legal battle over felons' voting rights. Ryan Daly reports that a recent class, Leon County Sheriff shared insights into how he, his peers, and the formerly incarcerated view the issue.
Mark Schlackman has a good deal of expertise related to Florida's system of restoring voting rights for those with a felony in their past. Schlackman, senior program director for FSU Law School's Center for Advancement of Human Rights, even has an amicus or friend of the court brief filed in the federal district court case. It gives background and statistics that provide context to the issue, and he brings that historical lens to his class.
Go back to 75. Which was about the same time that the office was established, the Office of Executive Clemency. The governor and cabinet had been the clemency board for quite some time. This was just the office. But it was at that time that Florida's standard was restoration upon completion of sentence.
The class of about 20 students is open to graduate and undergrad students. It brings in students from the colleges of law, social work, and social sciences and public policy. Schlackman says the idea was to have students whose fields of study are related to the issue discuss it as the legal battle unfolds. Schlackman calls it a convergence of issues, such as law.
It goes right to the core of the principles of federalism and separation of powers.
Political science.
It has principles of governance. So the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy, specifically political science.
And social work.
It has dimensions into reentry. Well, the College of Social Work, you know, was immediately interested.
One of the things that, as I talk to those persons who are coming back, is that there is no hope.
That's Sheriff Walt McNeil, who was a guest speaker at a recent class.
When you take hope away from a person and you say that you are forever not a citizen of your community, because you don't have the fundamental right of every citizen.
McNeil is a member of the Big Bend After Reentry Coalition. AFTER, an acronym, stands for A Fight to End Recidivism. He's also a former Florida Department of Corrections secretary. McNeil has met with representatives of South Korea and visited Iceland to compare how both nations' penal systems seek to lower recidivism. He told the class a population without voting rights will become disconnected from the political process entirely.
Keep in mind, from a political perspective, as a politician, that group is a non-group, because they can't impact me as a politician, but they can't vote. If you give them the right to vote, and they have a voice, and then they can exercise that power of the vote, I think you will see some change. And that's part of the dilemma.
McNeil says he has talked with peers who feel even after serving the sentence handed down by a court, felons should be penalized. Under the current clemency system, each person must wait a mandatory 5 years to even be considered for restoration.
The belief by some in law enforcement is that we need to punish people, that punishment needs to continue for, and they need to prove that they belong back in society. And that's why we're talking about a 5-year waiting period.
Brooke, who requested her last name not be used, is a political science undergraduate student who enrolled in the class.
I really enjoyed the conversation with the sheriff and how he said actually allowing people to be civically engaged will help decrease recidivism.
Brooke says what McNeil shared with the class resonated with her own experience.
Having seen different government programs in my own life in a low-income household, based on lack of education about those programs or lack of awareness, I definitely see how that can psychologically affect somebody to be less civically engaged, because you feel like the information is not easily accessible, or basically like it's working against you.
And Brooke's theory seems based in reality. Using his own research on the numbers, Schlackman made a calculation on how many people have successfully had their rights restored via the current clemency board's process.
Over the course of the past 7.5 years, only about 3,000 people have regained their civil rights.
Those 3,000 represent a drop in the bucket of the total number of people who have completed sentences. Schlackman says that's about 60,000 people per year, and over the course of the terms of the current governor and cabinet, nearly 450,000. If Schlackman's calculations are correct, that's less than 1% of people getting rights restored, and that's why, Schlackman says, he doesn't treat the class as an advocacy course, instead using it to teach the true impact.
And this isn't about left versus right or Republican versus Democrat. It's just cutting through the chaff.
Schlackman will teach the course on executive clemency again in the fall, coinciding with the Citizens Initiative Amendment calling for automatic restoration on the ballot in November. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Starting next month, a county in the Florida Panhandle will join 6 others across the state in taking over the child protective investigative duties of the state's Child Welfare Agency. As Sasha Cordner reports, Walton County's Sheriff's Office received legislative approval this year and the funds to do just that.
The role of child protective investigators within the Florida Department of Children and Families is to investigate claims of abuse and neglect. Currently, 6 sheriff's offices across the state have made agreements with DCF to take over that role. They are Broward, Hillsborough, Manatee, as well as Pasco, Pinellas, and Seminole counties. And now, with a legislative change, Walton County Sheriff's Office will join them. Panama City Republican Senator George Gaynor spearheaded that effort in the Florida legislature.
We believe that the legislation will allow for a quicker response and better outcomes because of the close proximity of the sheriff's personnel being coordinated under a single entity.
Ann Gaynor says letting Walton County take over the CPI operations will allow for more flexible investigations.
Because of fewer administrative barriers, Walton County Sheriff Atkinson and DCF have been working for more than a year to develop a contract that will put in place performance standards and protocol.
The final step in this process was receiving legislative approval in the form of a budget amendment. That means the legislature will now be able to transfer funding that normally would have gone to DCF to Walton County Sheriff's Office, specifically to handle child protection in that area. There is also now a new provision in state law that not only applies to Walton County, but four other sheriff's offices across the state that have been doing similar work for nearly two decades. Before, the statute read the sheriff's offices of Pasco, Manatee, Broward, and Pinellas counties have the responsibility to provide all child protective investigations in their counties. Now, with Walton County included, it states those same sheriff's offices shall provide all child protective investigations in their counties. That means if DCF sees that any of these counties can't meet the caseloads or fail in any way, a child welfare agency can take over those CPI services again. Meanwhile, Walton County Sheriff Mike Atkinson says his reasons for doing this is simple.
We're doing it because it is ultimately in the best interest of these children, and that's the driving factor.
Ann Atkinson adds this will also make it easier for his sheriff's office to add additional investigators, which will help with caseloads.
It is tough, hard work. It's very difficult for the men and women that do that particular job, but we think by working together, we can provide a better service to the kids. And at the end of the day, that is what we're about. So I'm excited. I'm excited that I think we're going to have some continuity, hopefully.
Walton County Sheriff's Office is currently putting the final touches on its agreement with DCF. The change will officially take effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, you've heard of various so-called third rail issues in politics, right? The reference is to the rail that provides electrical power to commuter trains in certain parts of the country. If you should touch that rail, you're dead. So too with issues such as Social Security, gun control, immigration, topics so volatile and divisive that candidates who talk openly about them may risk political death. In Florida, one topic long considered a third rail issue is offshore drilling. That perhaps more than any other matter has unified the vast majority of Floridians, liberal and conservative, Democrat, Republican, Independent, nearly every resident and policymaker in the state, seemingly since the discovery of petroleum, has been opposed to fossil fuel drilling off Florida's coastlines. But now there's a new campaign to promote drilling, at least exploratory drilling, in the waters of the eastern Gulf of Mexico and off the Atlantic coast. It's called Explore Offshore, and it's a coalition of community organizations, associations, businesses, and local leaders across the Southeast. One of Florida's three campaign chairs is former Crestview Area Chamber of Commerce Director and Okaloosa County Commissioner Wayne Harris. He says for him, it all began with a call from Brett Doster, the guy who ran Harris's unsuccessful 2016 bid to succeed Matt Gaetz as state representative.
Brett kind of came to me a couple months back and said, "Hey, listen, we've got a coalition we're putting together. They're helping the API, American Petroleum Institute."
Brett Doster, by the way, is widely considered one of Florida's most successful Republican consultants. His firm, Frontline Strategies, has worked for the Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush presidential campaigns. He's helped Pam Bondi and Adam Putnam. He also took some heat for coordinating Roy Moore's Alabama Senate bid. The Explore Offshore campaign would open up heretofore off-limits areas of the eastern Gulf and Atlantic coast to exploration. Harris says that could be done without having drilling rigs in sight of land.
There is new technology now that, the way I look at it, you see a lot of fiber being put into directional drilling stuff. You can be in one place and drill to another place and avoid interfering with things.
One thing that could potentially be interfered with is the military. A huge chunk of the airspace over the Gulf of Mexico is a testing range for Northwest Florida's sprawling Air Force operations. Harris believes exploratory drilling and military operations can peacefully coexist.
I don't want to do anything that would impact the ranges that are out there, but at the same time, having our own renewable sources and sustainable sources of energy is also national security.
Although Harris does acknowledge domestic oil and natural gas output does go on the international market, so there are presently no guarantees that what's drilled here stays here. But perhaps the most persistent and potent force against offshore drilling is Florida's tourism industry, which has been almost violently opposed to the idea since forever. Harris says he probably understands that better than most.
After going through the BP oil spill as chairman of the commission, I want to make sure that our beaches are safe and our tourism is safe. I mean, that was devastating to our tourism industry, as you well know.
Someone else who knows is Kim Ross. She's the executive director of Rethink Energy Florida, an organization that favors non-fossil fuel sources of power, such as wind and solar.
We lost 50,000 jobs in Florida because of the Deepwater Horizon spill. That didn't come to anywhere except for our most western shores. And we're talking about jobs lost in Tampa and other coastal cities. People didn't come that summer to Florida because there was a spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
No matter what the Explore Offshore campaign does to try and assure nervous tourism businesses that such a thing couldn't happen again, Ross is skeptical.
The money that we make from the tourism industry is so much more important than anything that we can get from the oil and gas industry expanding drilling here in the state of Florida and especially off our coasts.
And Ross has a theory as to why the pro-drilling campaign is gearing up now.
Of course, we have Amendment 9 that's going to be on the November ballot here in Florida, and that would put a permanent moratorium on nearshore drilling on our Constitution so that it can't flow according to the way the wind's blowing.
The current federal regulatory structure is much more industry-friendly than it has been, and they might need some help as another important date approaches.
In addition, in 2022, the moratorium that's at the federal level on the Eastern Gulf is also up for a vote. So they're starting early to push for that to open up and to really drive forward their policies and their ideas.
Hoping perhaps to at least partially de-energize Florida's politically deadly third rail issue of offshore drilling. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Noah Hertz. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at Rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.